Tonight on Arena, Theo Dorgan on his new novel, Camarade, and we celebrate Back to the Future at 40. Theo Dorgan is an award-winning poet, editor and broadcaster, and to add to his multi-hyphenate collection of roles, Theo has just published Camarade, his second novel. It's set between Cork and Paris, revolves around the story of Joseph Lyons, an Irish man who has lived his life in exile because of a single act of violence in his youth. Delighted to have Theo in studio with me this evening. And I was asking even before we came to air about Camarade, and I presume that is a reference to the French part of the story, but also to the Spanish Civil War part of the
story.
Well,
there's that. And also the idea, the term comrade has acquired too many narrow associations, whereas comradeship, as that kind of, you know, between somewhere between affection, friendship and relationship, it's a lovely word and it's a lovely concept, you know. And I wanted to bring it back. But if I call it comrade, you know, people would assume it's just, you know, a sectarian political description. But I like the idea of camaraderie, you know, that sort of affinity people feel for each other. And it's kind of near family. And yeah. Joseph finds near family in exile in Paris.
Yeah, and in fact, he has grown up in a near family type of situation as well, in that he's orphaned quite young and he's brought up by his grandfather. And his grandfather, even within the house where Joseph is growing up, there are lots of camarades or comrades, and there are references to the World War II and the resistance and to the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, all of those things. And he ends up being taken in by kind of a discontented, semi-detached wing of the PSAF, the French Communist Party. But really, their politics is the politics of permanent resistance. You know, and it's based in an ethical idea of kindness and comradeship. And that's the milieu that he goes from that milieu in a core context in the 1950s to spending the rest of his life in that milieu in Paris. I've always been taken by that idea that, you know, the idea of elective affinity, that you find your tribe. Something that really touched me was a very dear woman friend of mine, a very gifted historian and activist in her own way. She said, it's a book full of good men. And there aren't that many books about good men. I didn't write it with that in mind. There are also some wonderful, powerful women, I must say. And I can talk about it
like that. And there's a couple of bad men too.
Oh yeah, but I can talk about it like that because, as you know, and as I've said all these years over poetry, you don't write the poems write you. This wrote me. There was no plan.
Yeah, and was it Joseph who knocked on the door?
Well, Joseph knocked on the door, yeah, because I suppose we all have the life that might have been. And one of the lives that might have been for me is to grow old in Paris on a second floor apartment in a relatively quiet area in a huge book-lined apartment, entirely content to be solitary. Now, nobody who knows me would say I had any gift for being solitary, but I cherish
solitude. Was that ever an option?
Well, it was. I mean, it's always an option for all of us. But I remember the first time I went to Paris, it was 1982, was the night Mitterrand was elected and landed into the Place de la République. He made a new ministry, le ministre de temps libre, the minister for free time. Right?
It's not a marvelous concept. You were thinking of applying, were you?
Well, I just thought, well, you know, this could be a place you could be at home in. And there was an enormous party in the Place de la République, you know, and there was, and I thought, you know, this is a place I could, and I felt at home immediately there. You know, we all have this sensation. You find a particular place in the world that's not your birthplace, but you feel at home there.
That's interesting because...
I have that sense of Paris.
Yeah, and Joseph does find a way of living in Paris that he seems to be reasonably happy.
Yeah.
But the opening line of the novel, it reads, "All things considered, I wonder if shooting that policeman made me the man I am." And in some ways, the novel kind of falls out of that question.
It does, in a sense. I suppose, do we
choose our destiny? Does the destiny choose us?
And there you go. And that's I have no resolution for that. But then I don't write to find resolutions. I write to find out what happens. You know? And this went along just the way a poem does. You know, things come in and you say, oh, right, and you put it down. I'll tell you a funny thing. After a couple of years after I'd finished this, it's been out there for a while. I haven't done anything with it. But I was in Paris. And I had a kind of vague sense I was going to run into these lads and these women, you yeah. know. And it's kind of a curious ghost sensation. You know the way
yeah.
you vaguely remember people you met in London years ago or in New York years ago or wherever, you know. And I had a kind of a half uncomfortable feeling that I should be getting in touch with the lads, you know.
Yeah, they're characters now, Theo.
Yeah,
but to you, they're clearly very real people. That opening sentence, I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that Joseph is involved in this situation where he finds himself shooting at a special branch man who none of us would be too sad was shot at. What happens to the special branch man, I think we should leave for the reader to find out.
We should. And do you want to talk about why it happens?
Yeah, well, that's certainly a reason.
You see, the thing is, Joseph's parents die. They drive there in their car accident into the river they're drawn. He's brought up by his grandfather. His grandfather commanded a flying column in the War of Independence. The grandfather went away to America. Then he ended up in the Spanish Civil War. He ended up with the resistance, with his friend Henri. And Henri is the man that he sends Joseph on to when he has to be got offside.
Yeah.
But he's a man who didn't take part in the Civil War. And this is a bit that blindsided me as well. I didn't think this was coming, but he refused with a single sentence, "I could not shoot the men I fought for." And I was very struck when I did that staging the treaty thing there years ago, by the fact that these were all comrades and there was such a bitterness in the split. But there were men and women who refused to take part in the Civil War because they could not shoot the men they fought for.
Yeah.
And that's the grandfather style. When the 56-62 border campaign starts up, the branch drop around to ask the grandfather, "Listen, are you staying out of this?"
Here.
And he says, "No, absolutely. I have nothing to do with this." But there's a young branch man there who takes an irrational, vicious hatred to Joseph. And, you know, that's an interesting thing. It happens between young men, young bulls in a field, you know. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. When he popped up, I thought, oh, that's very interesting. Now, what's going to happen to him? And he ends up being shot by Joseph because to get at Joseph, he sexually assaulted the sister of a school friend.
Yeah.
So there's all this. But here's the thing. After the book had come out, but, you know, days after it had come out, I suddenly remember that when I was 11 or 12, I can't be sure of the dates, Tomás Óg McCurtain, son of the martyred Lord Mayor, shot a branchman on the streets of Cork. He was being dogged, followed around footstep. In every step he took, this guy was there. And eventually he lost the head, turned around and shot him. The guy died. And I remember thinking, when I was a schoolboy in primary, I must remember this.
And it makes its way into this novel.
And it popped up to solve the problem of how are we going to deal with this pup of a branch man. You know, and things like that. It was only 3 days ago, 4 days ago, I suddenly thought, oh, yes, of course. You know that famous Sean Keating painting, Men of the South? That's where the grandfather and his lodgers, his former comrades.
They could be the people who actually posed for that picture.
So, you know, stuff goes in and it gestates away and then it announces itself. So you just write down to see what happens next. You follow the story.
Well, funny enough, you said that when you went to Paris, it was just after Mitterrand became president. When Joseph goes to Paris, it's at a very specific time in French history.
Yeah, and he lands in there and, see, people forget, it's the power that people in ordinary jobs have, you know, the real power. He's brought in as a porter in the Sorbonne. Now, in the way the world is these days, think porter, bottom of the ladder. No, these guys have insinuated themselves. They formed a cell, a political cell in the university. They go everywhere. They meet everyone. They talk to everyone. They have access to all the learning of the university. And Joseph has a fantastic university education. Every now and then he goes out and shelves a few books, you know. But they have their own nest down in the basement with their armchairs and their radios. And they do their work, but they have other work on hand as well. So he's brought up by these men. And many of them are Algerian. And we don't, in Ireland, because we're so locked into the Anglo-Saxon history sphere, we don't really know what happened in other European countries all through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. Some events come up, like Paris 68 comes up, and I stick Joseph into that as well.
Yeah.
But the murder, the ferocious murder of Algerians in the 1950s in Paris, when over 200 were beaten to death and thrown into the River Seine, you know, that comes in. I wanted to put that in because I happen to be staying in the Centre Culturel writing some of this book in October when the anniversary of that massacre takes place, and I was down and watching people laying reeds in the river, you know, and I thought, we need to know more about these things.
And it struck me, in fact, in some ways, there's a character called Vincent who is an Algerian Joseph sees him at one point stealing a car. It turns out that, in fact, it's a kind of a setup.
Yeah.
And Vincent wants to see, will I be treated differently for stealing this car?
Vincent is a law student in the Sorbonne. Yeah. So he steals a car, but he has his law books and he's dressed very neatly and very nicely, the blazer, the shirt and tie. And he wants to see, would he be treated different to an Algerian kid in a tracksuit with a shaved head, you know?
Yeah, and looking at that whole idea, which is very contemporary in many ways across all sorts of parts of the world. But it struck me there were parallels for sure. And, you know, Joseph and Vincent kind of bounce off each other in some ways in this respect.
Again,
parallels between the Irish situation post-colonial and the Algerian situation post-colonial. Did that catch you by surprise?
Well, I suppose yes and no is the answer. I'm not being unhelpful in saying yes and no. Yes, in the sense I didn't think it would be that specific. But I know that the thing about writing a novel, for me, is it's kind of unbuttoning the shirt buttons. Sit back, relax. You have space, you have time. Poetry is so concentrated and it's moments. And I'm mostly, I suppose, down through the years, but what I've been writing about the dilemma of discovering you're singular, you're mortal, you're born alone, you die alone, you have this world to be a witness to. In a novel, there's more space for, it's a reflective space. You can make space for these characters to announce themselves. And so I suppose some of my political preoccupations came out in it. But I had to be, well, I don't think there was any real danger. I don't think I'd work like that. But, you know, you could see the danger of turning it into a polemic or politics by numbers.
Yeah, well, I saw...
Because they're all peculiar characters in their own way, you know.
I could see parallels, certainly, with Irish situations, but I wondered, that's me. Like, for example, the Paris massacre that you spoke about, I could see parallels, not in terms of scale, but you could see parallels with Bloody Sunday and Derry. You know, it was roaring out at me.
Well, since the dawn of time, institutional power is the same everywhere. And at all times.
And there was one other thing that I did want to pick on before we finish up, which is I decided not just to live in another country, this is Joseph speaking, but in another language. Yeah. And he befriends Sam Beckett at one point along the way as well. And that's kind of interesting because obviously...
You kind of just bump into each other, as happens.
But that idea of another language and, you know, he decided to take on the French. At home here, we didn't decide to take on English. Can those ideas be to the front of your mind when you're writing it, or would that turn it into a polemic?
Well, it sounds a strange way of putting it, but that's the kind of thing that preoccupied the characters, not me.
Yeah, they're not me. Yeah, yeah.
You know, every day something new happened. I sit down to write and I say, that's all right. No, so where's that going? And I'm following it. But of course, naturally, my own subconscious or semi-conscious preoccupations come up. One of the things I try to do technically in the book is when the French characters are speaking, I try to use a kind of a French syntax when they speak English.
Mm.
And it was hilarious. I had a copy editor who was a middlebrow, middle-class English, who kept saying, but this isn't proper English. I said, no,
dear, not meant to
be. You're kind of missing the point here, you know.
And that is part of that kind of play with language that you seem to be at. And I guess that's part of it. Part of that is coming from the poet within you as well.
And from a lifetime's reflection on the fact that our Irish English has its particular savour and its particular register because the ghost syntax of Gaeilge is inside it. Like, the Irish language is in love with the conditional tense. Anglo-Saxon English likes facts and nouns. And we negotiate, we slither between the two.
Why would you say that?
might you be saying that because you have a reason? You know, we do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I have to say, it was writing it was, in a sense, it was play. But I learned things about my own preoccupations of the world from these guys. And these women, I quoted my friend as saying, "No, there's a lot of good men in this book. There are a lot of powerful women as well."
They sure are.
And they get, and they're mad about Joseph. That might might be a little bit of automaker projection or wishful thinking. Yeah.
Well, listen, Joseph is a mighty man and a very attractive character. Kamerad is the name of the book that Theo Dorgan has been speaking to us about, and it is published by Mercier Press. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. It's now the stuff of publishing and book legend when Alan Lane was standing in a train station and wanted something to read. He had an idea. You could say a truly brilliant idea. Why not publish books, make them small, portable and above all, inexpensive, then people can read just about anywhere. He wanted books to cost sixpence. This was back in 1935 or thereabouts, the price of a packet of cigarettes at that time. And in so doing, he and his brothers revolutionised the lives of readers, writers, publishers and booksellers. They set up the now legendary Penguin Books and then Viking, which led to Puffin Books, which made lifelong readers out of many children. We all have an orange spine book of some kind on our bookshelves featuring the iconic Penguin logo, and now Penguin is celebrating 90 years since that first genius gem of an idea. With me in studio to help us celebrate is Henry Elliott, writer and historian, who I think knows more than anyone about this particular story. But I've been reading Henry, around Alan Lane. And it's such a great story. There he was. I think the train was either going to Exeter or coming from Exeter. I can't remember which. He's standing on the platform. He's looking at this bookshop. Books are all terribly expensive. They're not very good. And he thinks, what can I do? And he comes up with this idea. How true is the myth? How much of a myth maker was he as well as a great bookseller?
Yeah, it's a great question, because from the very beginning, Penguin was really good at telling stories about itself. You know, I like to remember that in 1945, when the Second World War had just finished, Penguin published a special publication, not about that, about the fact that they were 10 years old. They loved, you know, from the very beginning, they were celebrating anniversaries, and here we are celebrating another one.
So, yeah, never mind that the war is over. We're 10!
Yeah, we're 10! Yeah, exactly. But yes, this, I mean, it's a great story, isn't it? Mm. He's standing there on Exeter St. David's Station. He'd just been spending the weekend with his good friend Agatha Christie in her big house down on the River Dart, and he was looking for a book. And who knows how true it is? I mean, one reason we could take it with a pinch of salt is that it's said that although he spent his whole career in publishing, Alan Lane wasn't actually much of a reader himself. I mean, one example of that is he commissioned the first Penguin Classics title after reading just three chapters of this translation of the Odyssey, and was like, yep, that'll do, we'll publish it.
But he had a good nose, because that book was hugely successful.
Well, that was, I think if I had to point to two ways in which Alan Lane was a genius, one is that he was great at self-mythologizing, telling these stories. The other way is that he was great at making good decisions fast. Mm. And that's a really good example of it.
The Odyssey was one of those. Anyway, I interrupted you as to whether this is a myth or not. I suppose in some ways, doesn't matter. It's a great story.
I think that's the point, isn't it? I'm sure there's a grain of truth in there. He certainly came back from Devon with this idea, and the way he told it later is that it was the next morning in Talbot Square in London, where in this flat that he shared with his two brothers, Dick and John. And they had this slightly unusual morning ritual where one brother would have a bath, one brother would shave, and the other one would sit on the chair, and they'd kind of rotate round these positions and chat.
Sounds like the beginning of Ulysses in some ways.
It sounds exactly like that. I hadn't thought of that. And apparently it was the next morning in the bathroom, when Alan himself was in the bath, where he proposed this idea to his brothers, because they were all working for the Bodley Head, where their distant cousin John had set up this successful publisher. But what they were suggesting was branching out on their own, putting their own money in and starting this new venture. And it was a risk. They didn't know what would happen.
Well, to get a sense of, you know, how novel, no pun intended, but it was a truly brilliant and innovative idea. The paperback could be put into the pocket, could be carried anywhere, could be read on the train, all of the above. And it was going to be affordable. What was the situation? You know, if the ordinary man or woman on the street in 1935, when Penguin was set up, thought, I'd like to get a book and I'd like to read it. What was their situation? How much money did they have in their pocket? And did they have to have very big pockets, not just for the money, but for the book?
For the physical books. Yeah, it's a really good point. Basically, the market was quite divided. And the kind of literary better books were expensive, they were in hardback, and they seldom went to paperback at all. You could buy paperbacks, but they tended to be cheaper editions and less interesting books as well. What's interesting is that, not in Britain, but on the continent, in Germany, there were two paperback series which Alan Lane really admired, and they were quite successful. There was one called Tauschnitz, which had been going for almost 100 years, and then a more recent one called Albatross Books, not the most auspicious name for a literary endeavour. But they published English language classics in Germany, and they'd done quite well. So I think he took that element, and you're right, he made it affordable. And the way he did that was by printing these very, very large print runs so that the economies of scale brought the cost right down.
It was at 17,000. There was a specific number worked out. If you printed 17,000 books, you could sell them at sixpence each.
It's something like that. Yeah, exactly. They had to. It was a lot of books. And when they started, they didn't know if it would work. And actually, they only put covers on half the print run because they didn't know if this was going to work. Of course it did. And within, you know, the first ones came out exactly 90 years ago on the, you know, at the end of July 1935. By the next March, they sold 1 million copies. It just, it worked brilliantly.
Yeah. And it was 10 books in the original.
In the first batch. They added more.
And I was looking at some of the titles were quite familiar to me, but most of them, I have to say, are going, I don't know if I know that writer. I don't know if I know that particular book. You know, what was he? Well, I see there's an Agatha Christie there, for example. You know, so I was hardly surprised with that, given that it was Alan Lane's friend. I'm trying to look at...
As a Hemingway in the first one.
Yes, Farewell to Arms. That was obviously... Yeah. That was obvious and familiar. A lot of others. I'm not so... E.M. Young, a book called William.
Yeah. It's so true. And those early days especially, it was a bit of a rag bag. And none of these books were new. They all existed. Mm. And really, in those first few batches, it was whatever Alan and his brothers could get the rights for from these. And, you know, of that first batch of 10, 6 of those rights came from Jonathan Cape. And he later said, I didn't think you stood a chance. I thought I'd make a quick 300 quid from you and you'd fold within the year. So a lot of these publishers were kind of giving the rights for the paperback publication, not expecting it to go very far.
I was interested that you brought up the German version, if you like. And it did predate this, and Alan was aware of it. So it wasn't just standing on a platform on the way home from Exeter that he came up with this idea. Albatross, as you say, maybe not the best name for any endeavour, because it's bound to fail in some ways, isn't it? So how did they come up with the name Penguin? Let's listen to Alan Lane himself telling us that story.
When we decided we were going to have a go at this idea, which we thought was a good one, of producing sophisticated books for an intelligent public at a very low price, one night we were milling around in the office and my secretary said, what about a penguin? And we thought, this is absolutely spot on. It's got what we thought we had in those days when we were younger, a certain dignified flippancy. It's a lovable little bird. And we thought, well, this is exactly what we want.
There we have Alan Lane, one of the founders, one of the three founders, along with his brothers Richard and John, of Penguin, celebrating 90 years of publishing this year, is the Penguin Publishing House. And Henry Elliott, a historian, is with me in studio this evening talking about just that. He knew how to even hit a phrase, dignified flippancy.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And I think it's spot on as well. I think that is the secret of that Penguin, that there is something smart and dignified about it. You know, you feel like you have a proper book when you've got a Penguin book, but he's also fun. There's something attractive about that.
Yeah, okay. And later on, as many of us did as children, one of the first set of books we bought possibly was a Puffin book.
Sure.
And you could graduate from a Puffin to a Penguin.
Even
that was a very clever marketing tool.
Very clever. I mean, they went a little bit far with some of those P words. You know, they had ptarmigan books with a silent P, you know, that didn't work quite so well.
That was for the very clever.
Yes, they had peregrine books, they were a bit more popular. They had pauper's books, which really didn't work very well. But yes, they, you know, I think that Penguin, they went through all sorts of animals in that meeting. Apparently they thought about camel books, dolphin books, phoenix books. And I think Joan Coles, his secretary, got it absolutely right with the Penguin.
He also talked there about sophisticated books for an intelligent audience. And again, clever marketing. You know, I want to be part of that audience, do I? But not only did they do that, they've got the books. And this was another business, a really clever business decision. They got the books into Woolworths, which was the discount, the big discount store of the time. You could go in there with not too much money in your pocket and come out with something. And so they cleverly got that big market to buy these books. Whether they read them or not is another day's work.
It's so true. Yes, they were selling these books in different places. Woolworths, as you say, train platforms. It was a different style of bookselling. It wasn't the stuffy, old-fashioned bookshops where you might have to knock on the door, ring a bell to go inside. These were available. They were there when you were picking up your daily shop. It was just a different way of buying books. And on that point, and the sophistication of them, it's interesting that they were founded in 1935, and actually the Second World War came at a good time for Penguin, because suddenly there was a public sitting at home looking for distraction with not much else to do. Yeah. And you know, George Orwell has written about this, how suddenly the reading public, they were reading much more ambitious books than they'd ever read before because of sitting at home. It was a little bit like Disney Plus landing during lockdown.
Yeah, I was thinking it has big comparisons in that respect. But the other aspect that I'm thinking about the wartime period was, I don't know whether it was clever business decision or whether it was accidental. There was paper rationing based on the number of books you had published or printed the previous year.
Exactly. So it was Penguin had a real commercial advantage during the war because their whole model was based on printing these very large print runs. When the paper rationing came out, you're right, it was based on how much you'd published in the previous
year. And not how many were sold or anything.
No, no,
like,
no.
How many
did you print?
How much
paper you had used. So they had a real commercial advantage. They had much. I mean, it was still tight. They were always complaining they didn't have enough paper during the war. But they had much more than any other publisher.
Now, you are in Dublin, and you're in Dublin to celebrate this 90 years. We couldn't talk about Dublin without talking about James Joyce and Alan's. Was it a lifelong ambition to get the paperback rights to Ulysses?
Absolutely. I mean, he was obsessed with that book, partly because he was in New York when Random House published their 1934 edition, which transformed Random House into the huge publisher that it still is today. And so he saw what could be done. And within a week of that publication, he bid for the rights. Joyce wanted to go with Faber because they were already committed to publishing Finnegan's Wake. But T.S. Eliot at Faber had 5 days to decide, and he bottled it. He couldn't take the risk and publish Ulysses. So Alan Lane got the rights for Bodley Head, where he was working, and I think he was frustrated because his board stalled, and it took him his editorial board, 2 years before they could publish Ulysses. And by then, he'd said, look, I'm out of here. You're moving too slow for me. I'm off to make a Penguin. So yeah, he got the rights, and he had to leave them behind at Bodley Head, who published the first British edition of Ulysses. And it wasn't until 1969, when he was about to retire, he'd been 50 years in the publishing business, and to mark his retirement, the 3,000th Penguin book was finally the paperback of Ulysses.
Oh, and the fact getting it at that 3,000th was a lovely quality to it as well. And did he pay big money for those
paperback
rights?
Huge money. It was a record sale for paperback rights. It was £75,000 to publish the paper, which he paid to Bodley Head for those rights, which was unheard of. But it shows how much what a landmark book that was for him.
But he kind of was good on the business-making decisions, and as you say, this nose for a book. Lady Chatterley's Lover and the court case in and around that. I mean, he played his cards so cleverly here.
Yeah.
I just explain the controversy that there was at the time.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened was in 1959, the British government passed the Obscene Publications Act, which essentially limited what people could publish if it could be seen as obscene. And so the following year, in this very well-publicised case, Alan Lane deliberately tested the boundaries of this new act, and they told the authorities that they were planning to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover. They took 12 copies. Hans Schmoller, the designer, took 12 copies to Holborn Police Station and handed them to the Metropolitan Police, and they had to initiate a trial. It was Regina versus Penguin Books. And basically, they had to prove that this was a literary book. Yeah. So Sir Alan Lane, he was knighted by then, he took the stand and argued it. He got E.M. Forster up on the stand to talk about it. He'd recently published in Pelican an academic called Richard Hoggart. He came up, and he even got the Bishop of Woolwich up to argue.
They were helped along, however, by a rather foolish prosecutor who, you know, think before you speak. Certainly think before you speak in a courtroom.
Yeah, he had that famous line, didn't he, where he said, is this the kind of book you would want your wives and servants to read? And it just, I think what that line does is illustrates how this was such a watershed moment for culture in Britain. You know, on one side was a kind of Edwardian, Victorian set of values.
Your wives and servants need to be kept in their place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, even just, you know, there's so much wrong with that sentence.
Mm.
And on the other side of this, because of course, famously, the court ruled in favour of Penguin. On the other side of that is the swinging 60s. It kind of let in the era.
It opened that up. Let's listen to Alan Lane once again, this time speaking about that particular case around Lady Chatterley's Lover.
You knew when you decided to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover, Sir Alan, that there would be a court case, didn't you?
I thought it was highly probable.
And yet you went ahead with it. How much did the cost of printing
About £10,000.
And then there's also the court case, which are...
Which would be about the same. About 20,000 together.
So that you gambled £20,000 on the result of the case?
Yes, if you put it in that way, yes.
What would have happened to the books if the case had gone against you?
Well, I've been asking myself that. I don't know. I don't know what the law is. I don't know whether we would have been allowed to send them abroad into other countries where they're allowed to be sold, or whether they'd have made an order for their destruction.
What do you think will be the effect of this decision on literature and publishing generally?
I think it'll be extremely good. I think that at last we know where we are, and I think from now on, any serious book by a serious author, published by a reputable publisher, is in a much more safe position than it was until the result of the trial today.
And that's Alan Lane, founder of Penguin Books, talking about the court case in and around Lady Chatterley's Lover. He says there, oh, I had no idea what was going to happen. And he gambled whatever it was, £20,000. You can hear the toffee-nosed nature of the interviewer, even the judgment in the question itself. I presume he made that £20,000 and a lot more back.
It was a brilliant piece of publicity, apart from anything else. You know, they published a second edition in the following year, 1961. Mm. And by the end of 1961, they'd sold 3 million copies of Lady Chatterley's Lover. So it was extraordinary. But I think he's right. I mean, I think, you know, it's impressive, really, to hear that interview and hear him at the moment that it happened realize what a landmark moment this was. Because, you know, it has set the terms for publishing in the UK since, and has opened up a much freer publishing press. You know, I think Penguin did a great service to the industry there.
And one final thing I wanted to comment on was that when we talked about those original 10 books, the simplicity of the cover design, you know, it was three bands of colour with the Penguin logo on the bottom, name of the book in the middle in the white bit, and then it was either orange or blue, I think red in there by genre.
That's right.
The cover design, I remember huge fusses about when the cover design was being changed at different points along the way.
It's funny, isn't it? Because that design is so iconic. It's one of the great icons of 20th century design, isn't it? But actually, when you look back at the history, they started changing it really quite early on.
Mm.
And first of all, it went to a vertical grid rather than a horizontal one, and then it was abandoned altogether and then brought back in different ways. But I think it was a young editor called Edward Young who came up with that design. And you're right, I think it's for simplicity and even the simplicity of the typeface. They went for this sans serif Gill.
So clear.
Yeah. Exactly. It was just a very clear proposition. And I feel like that spirit continues with Penguin Publishing today.
In terms of Penguin Ireland then, when did Penguin Ireland come into being and then decide that, no, let's remember James Joyce and become Sandy Cove?
Yeah, well, you know, Penguin very quickly started opening offices in other territories around the world. You know, the American office opened, the Australian office. There's now, I think it's over 20 offices around the world in South Africa and Canada and in you know, all over the place. And it was in 2003 that Penguin Ireland opened on St. Stephen's Green in a very kind of Joycean location, just opposite where he was a student at University College Dublin. And so it marked its 21st birthday last year.
Yeah.
And it's going strong. And I think it's, you know, it's a testament to, you know, what a literary country Ireland is, like what incredible quality of authorship is over here, but also what a kind of literate country it is. And there are so many great bookshops and retailers here. It needs to be served by a local team.
And finally, a confession, if you could, for us, please. which Penguin book, as I'm told some young men did you put in your coat pocket in the hope that it would be noticed by somebody saying, look at what he's reading. He must be an incredible person be reading such a book. I want the truth on this one, Henry Elliott.
I'm worried I've done that too often. Well, this is the truth, actually. My favourite novel is That is Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern. And so I'm always proud to have that poking out of my pocket.
And is it a Penguin?
It certainly is, Penguin Classics. Yeah.
Okay. Not quite 90 years old, but the publishing house is. Henry, thanks so much for sharing those stories and thoughts for us around the history of Penguin Books. Penguin, founded by Alan Lane and his two brothers, Richard and John, 90 years ago, this July the 30th. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night! If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, it just might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future!
Yes, there you go. We're sending you back to the future right now as well. It's hard to believe. 40 years ago this month, a youthful Michael J. Fox jumped into a souped-up DeLorean based on that advice from Christopher Lloyd's Doc Brown. Then Marty McFly was catapulted through the space-time continuum and found himself living in 1955, hanging out with his parents as young people. The film Back to the Future was one of the biggest box office hits of the 1980s, of course, made a megastar of Michael J. Fox. He was already pretty big thanks to his work on the sitcom Family Ties, but the popularity of Back to the Future in the aftermath of its release is hard to overstate, and its popularity since then has only increased. However, believe it or not, the production had lots of teething problems, including famously a change of leading man. Stephen Benedict joins us to discuss its success and some of the lessons of its troubled making. Well, we have to go back to the past and how it all actually started, Stephen, I suppose.
Yeah, in the late 1960s, Robert Zemeckis enrolled in the film department of the University of Southern California, and there he befriended Bob Gale. They set up a writing partnership with Zemeckis directing and Gale producing. And then upon graduating, Robert Zemeckis actually won an Academy Award. He won an Oscar for his student film, A Field of Honor. And with that success, he was able to parlay a meeting with Steven Spielberg, who was just about to release Jaws. This was 1975. And then Spielberg was so impressed with the film that he offered to help Zemeckis' career. And he executive produced Zemeckis' first two films, I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars. That was the late 70s, early 1980s. And around about the same time, Bob Gale was leafing through his father's old school yearbook and came across the information that his dad had actually been the class president upon graduation. Yeah. And Gale said, I remember the class president in my class. He was a bit of a jerk. I wonder would I have liked my dad had I been a student in the same class. And so he started to talk to Robert Zemeckis about it. And they said,
so that Back to the Future kind of hook was actually Bob Gale's idea.
That's right. So it was the recollection of or wondering what it would have been like had I met my dad. And then the two of them said, that's a premise for a movie.
Yeah, and time travel, you think, well, if we're going to be talking time travel, we're in a world of sci-fi. But normally you're talking about saving the universe or, you know, some big thing like that.
Yeah.
This was a kind of had a different style of premise from the sort of thing that sci-fi fans might have been expecting.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because the year before The Terminator had come out and Sarah Connor has to save the world. And Marty McFly isn't doing anything on such a grand scale. And I think that one of the reasons why the movie had such a success is because they tapped into a subliminal aspect that we do every single day. We are constantly trying to relive or reconfigure conversations that we've had, or where did I leave my keys? Retrace my steps to go back in time. And we lose moments. We have moments of deep regret. We're trying to reclaim those. And the more we do that, the more we get caught up in the past. So I think, like all great stories, Back to the Future taps into a universal truth of human behaviour. But as you said, it's a sci-fi picture, but with a hell of a lot of comedy.
Yeah, because, I mean, we heard it in that first clip with Christopher Lloyd. Yeah. I know there's lots of, in inverted commas, science in there.
Yeah.
But really, it's comedy science in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think another thing about it is we've got to remember, you know, you mentioned in your introduction, they had a major change in the lead of the cast, Eric Stoltz. And
Eric Stoltz had been playing Marty McFly.
That's right. And he's a very fine actor, but he's not a comedian. That's as simple as that. And he doesn't have this manic energy that Michael J. Fox is able to bring to it. And he was able to match Christopher Lloyd, because Christopher Lloyd is just off the charts.
Yes.
He's absolutely, you know, crazy Doc Brown. And he seems to be fascinated by the science possibilities, while Michael J. Fox's character, Marty McFly, is terrified of them, because he knows that if they can't get back to the future, I won't even be born.
Yeah, and if he interferes in any way with, right, with his mother and father's romance, he could mess things up. So he has serious dilemmas to play with here. And of course, huge comedy potential in all of them. Let's have a listen to a clip where he finds himself back at school, not only with his father, also with his mother, and his sudden arrival, the whole thing, obviously, the past is possibly thrown off course. And what happens if mommy and daddy don't meet and fall in love, or if she falls in love with somebody else?
Doc, she didn't even look at him.
This is more serious than I thought. Apparently your mother is amorously infatuated with you instead of your father.
Whoa, wait a minute. Doc, are you trying to tell me that my mother has got the hots for me?
Precisely.
Whoa, this is heavy.
There's that word again, heavy. Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
What?
The only way we're going to get those two to successfully mate is if they are alone together. So you've got to get your father and mother to interact in some sort of social...
Well, what, you mean like a date?
Right.
Well, what kind of date? I don't know. What do kids do in the 50s?
Well, they're your parents. You must know them. What are their common interests? What do they like to do together?
Nothing.
Look, there's a rhythmic ceremonial ritual coming up.
Of course, the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. They're supposed to go to this. That's where they kiss for the first time.
All right, kid. You stick to your father like glue and make sure he takes you to that dance.
Christopher Lloyd is Doc Brown, Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, Back to the Future, 40 years old this year. Stephen Benedict with me in studio talking about just that. I mean, they really do set up the comedy potential of it all, and the idea that the son has to set up the mother and the father in order for him to be born.
Yeah.
It's a wonderfully convoluted but simple premise.
And the brilliant thing about it is that the way they mind the comedy is that they did something that is really unique for science fiction stories and science fiction fans. It's world building. They call it world building. The ability to immerse yourself in this completely fictive world. And it, you know, usually the time travel movies go into the future. And this one went into the past. So they had to set themselves within that reality of the past. And they mined so many brilliant jokes, because you have a joke about Ronald Reagan, who was the 1950s, was a Hollywood actor. He goes on to be the United States, president of the United States. And there's a beyond wonderful intertextuality play between all these movies, because Marty dresses up as a character. He claims his name is Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan. Star Trek and Star Wars, to this kid who doesn't know what either of those things mean, but the meta-ness of it, the audience get the joke that his dad doesn't. So that's the way it plays out. And I think that's one of the great things, because it's a science fiction plot. Time travel is science fiction. And as you said, they mined it with all these jokes, which made it absolutely fantastic.
I mean, sitting as we are talking about it here, 40 years later, you kind of wonder, who didn't see this potential? Who would even be questioning you? Keith, these guys come in with this story. Let's make this movie. Let's do it immediately. No, that's not how it happened.
Yeah, and that's quite often the way, because it's such a brilliant idea. As you said, why didn't someone think of it earlier? And it's so simple, but making it so simple was the really, really, really hard part.
Let's listen to Robert Zemeckis then, talking about some of the difficulties he had in getting the film made in the first place.
Everyone in town passed on Back to the Future. Bob and I had just finished Used Cars. Again, it's just one of those issues that you have to deal with in the business. I don't think that the decision not to make the movie was based on the material, obviously, because the material turned out to be incredibly successful. I think the decision to not make the film was based on the fact that, as a director, I had a very poor track record at the box office. So the movie just couldn't get made. And subsequently, what happened was, went off and directed Romancing the Stone. When that movie became successful, then everyone looked at the screenplay of Back to the Future differently, and so then everyone wanted to make Back to the Future. I must say, though, that there was one guy who always wanted to make Back to the Future, and I didn't want to make it with him, and that was Steven Spielberg, because I had made these two films that Steven produced, and they weren't successful, and I was afraid that if I had done another one with Steven and it wasn't successful, then I would be stigmatized as a director who can only get a movie made if Steven is his executive producer. So I said to Steven that I had to go off and make a movie away from him, which he completely understood and agreed with my career decision. So I went and I did Romancing the Stone. And then after that became successful and everybody wanted to then make Back to the Future, I felt it only appropriate and fair that I go back to the only guy who ever really wanted to make the movie to begin with. So we decided that that should be the next movie that I make, and he would executive produce it, and we'd go and make it for Universal.
Robert Zemeckis there is talking about the difficulties that he had getting anybody to back him in the making of Back to the Future, which seems extraordinary, as I was saying beforehand, Stephen Benedict there. And it, then, of course, he had that Oscar nomination and
the screenplay, yeah.
For the screenplay, for the best original screenplay. Mm. I mean, do executives ever come back and swallow their pride?
Apologise?
Yeah. I doubt it.
Do lawyers apologise? No.
I'm not prepared to make a comment on that.
No, my lawyer will be present for that. But the thing is, about the screenplay, they wrote the original draft in 1980. The movie wasn't made until 1984 or 1985.
So is that a long period of time between writing of a script and the making
of a
film?
Well, it depends how long is a piece of string. Mm. You know, there are movies you hear about that took them 20 years to make it and it becomes a labour of love. But the thing about Back to the Future, it's a great lesson for aspiring writers and students of film to understand that writing is rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, because the premise is brilliant, but they had to find their way into all the brilliant nooks and crannies of the comedy and the drama. Because if you think about it, originally the time machine wasn't a DeLorean car, it was a refrigerator. That's not funny. Mm. The way that Marty was propelled back into the future was not the bolt of lightning, it was an atomic bomb. That's not funny.
Yeah.
George, his dad originally was going to go up to be a boxer, not a novelist. That's not funny. So the tone, they had to tone everything down to find it, to find the right tone.
And I suppose part of that was also when Michael J. Fox came on board as Marty McFly, Eric Stoltz couldn't do the comedy lines, but Michael J. Fox was eating into them perfectly.
Absolutely.
And that came from family ties as much as anything else.
But I have yet to meet anybody who doesn't like Michael J. Fox anywhere in life. You mention a movie with Michael J. Fox, oh my God, I like him so much. He is a perennial. And, you know, the irony is that he's suffering from Parkinson's.
Yeah, and that wonderful documentary that he made about that.
If
you don't like him, go and watch that and you'll certainly like him after
that.
Yeah,
you know, the bravery and the integrity which he has shown over his entire career, and you say to yourself, wouldn't you like to go back in time to find a cure?
Yeah.
So we could enjoy him again. Because he is actually a Peter Pan type, because his youth is eternal now. You know?
Yeah. Well, listen, it's a film certainly that we will watch again and again and again and be celebrating well into the future. That's Stephen Benedict talking to us about Back to the Future, 40 years old this year. Tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan with Liam Mullen on sound and Ollie Hamilton as the broadcast coordinator.